Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I intend to take us through this time, Leviticus chapter 25, first half of the chapter, verses 1 through 22. We'll talk about the famous Sabbath year and the equally famous year of Jubilee. Our context is this. In our last chapter, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 23, we talked about the furniture in the holy place. We talked about blasphemy. We talked about eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, some miscellaneous laws. So now we begin in Leviticus 25, 1 through 7. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field, nor prune your vineyard. Your harvests after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. All of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat." Now, these first seven verses talk about the famous Sabbath year, the sabbatical year, from which we get the term sabbatical when college professors go off and do their research and don't teach. They're supposed to keep working, but the idea of a Sabbath is rest. That's the way I always looked at it. Now, having a Sabbath year, every 7 years the Israelites were not to plant crops, this fallow year accomplished much the same purpose as crop rotation, as the NIV Study Bible points out. The Israelites did not, in fact, practice crop rotation, and this was their substitute. I have a question here. Well, there was volunteer growth, as we'll see, that grew up during the Sabbath year. Didn't that volunteer growth suck nutrients from the land? Must not have been enough to really hurt the land's fertility. I suppose that's the answer to that. The purpose of the Sabbath year, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill say, is to keep the land fertile. As all good farmers know, you just can't keep planting land over and over again. You suck all the nutrients out to where it won't grow crops anymore. Another purpose, besides the practical purpose of keeping the land fertile, is that the fallow year, the seventh year of no crops, provides a type of the Sabbath rest believers receive in Christ, as John Gill says. The land rest and believers rest. The land is a type of the any type of our rest in Christ, where we don't have to work to get our salvation. The famous verse that points that out is Hebrews 4:1. "Therefore, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering his rest," that's talking about Jesus' rest, "any one of you may seem to have come short of it." So that's the second reason, the typological function the fallow land provides every 7 years. The third purpose of keeping the land fallow was it would teach people the providence of God in supplying their needs. Don't worry about it. You're not working, but God's still working. He'll take care of you. That's a great application point to not working one day a week. I've got to work 7 days a week or I can't support my family. Nonsense. You work 7 days a week and you don't take a day off, your productivity plummets, the risk of you making mistakes increases, the risk of you injuring yourself increases, and you end up making less than if you'd have taken the day off every week. Now, when did the first Sabbath year occur? I assume it's the seventh year after they entered the land. Some people say it's the 14th year because the first 7 years were spent in conquest and division of the land. They didn't have time to take a Sabbath year. That's John Gill suggests that. I don't know. I'm going to assume the seventh year after they get into the promised land, they took a year off. Now, verse 5 mentions aftergrowth. Your harvests aftergrowth you shall not reap, because you're not going to be working during the Sabbath year, so you don't reap the aftergrowth. Well, first of all, what is aftergrowth? That is crops that spring up by themselves from grains that are shed in the harvest of the preceding year. So in year 6, the grain is harvested. As it's harvested, the grain is full of seeds in the pods, and the seeds fall on the ground, and you don't plant them, they just fall, and the growth grows voluntarily. In fact, a lot of times people call that volunteer growth. Now, verse 6 says that even though you can't reap during the seventh year to produce crops, but you can eat crops. Verse 6 says, all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, the Sabbath products being the volunteer growth. You can have that volunteer growth for food. So we got a little problem here. Verse 5, it says, your harvest after growth you shall not reap. But here in verse 6, you can have the Sabbath products to eat. Well, the purpose of having the Sabbath, the volunteer products on the Sabbath year to eat is for the poor. It's kind of like the law of gleaning. Basically, what happens is this, the aftergrowth grows, but you are not going to reap it. You're going to leave it for the poor. Now, Matthew Poole says that what that means is you can reap it along with the poor, but you're not going to reap it by yourself. That's how he interprets that. Your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, i.e. by yourself. Well, it could be you don't reap it at all. Let the poor get the aftergrowth. Now, the owners of the land would not need to reap on that Sabbath year. They had a triple harvest from year 6, as we'll see at the last three verses of our section for this audio, Leviticus 25, 21 through 22. We read this, then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth a crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. I'll explain that further when we get there, but basically what that's saying is that on the sixth year, you reap a big crop. The seventh Sabbath year, you don't plant, and so you eat from your storage for the seventh Sabbath year, and you let the poor eat the aftergrowth in the seventh year. Then in the eighth year you're sowing, that's the first year of the next cycle, you still have to eat from storage because the harvest hadn't come in yet on the eighth year. But finally the harvest comes in on the eighth year, and then you can eat in the ninth year when the crop comes in for the ninth year, which is the second year of the next cycle. So Sabbath year you don't eat, first year of the next cycle you don't eat, and the second year of the next cycle you do eat. The owners had plenty of food. The volunteer growth was especially for the poor. This is especially shown to us in Exodus 23 verse 11, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest, let the land rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave the beast of the field may eat. You're to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. So Exodus 23 explicitly says it's for the poor that the aftergrowth is left over. And also in our verse here in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 6, the people that are mentioned are poor. All of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, your aliens. Slaves, hired folks, hired workers, and aliens, those are typically going to be poor people. And so the idea there is they're going to be taken care of. Now you're going to get to eat too from your crops. Well, it says right here, all of you shall have the Sabbath products of your land for food yourself, so you can share in that too. But basically it's to give to your dependents, your slaves, your hired people, and the proselytes that are with you. Basically the owner of the land is going to have a rich harvest from year 6. He's going to be eating out of storage. And then, of course, also the animals are going to eat from the volunteer growth also. So we go now to Leviticus 25, 8 through 10. You are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7th Sabbath of years, namely 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Day of Atonement. You shall sound a horn all through your land. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. Now, surprisingly to me, I've discovered there's sort of a big controversy amongst the commentators as to exactly what year was the jubilee year. Well, it says the 50th year in verse 10, so I thought that would be not a problem. But apparently it is. Some people say the year of Jubilee is started on the 49th year. In other words, the year of Jubilee is the seventh Sabbath year. There's not a double fallow year there at the end of the cycle. The NIV Study Bible says that Jewish sources from between the Testaments favor this. On the other hand, the other option is to say there's a 50th year of Jubilee that is added on to the 49th, the seventh Sabbath, the 49th year. Clark and the NIV Study Bible mentioned this. And of course, our scripture right here in verses 10 and 11 that I just read says, you shall consecrate the 50th year. Verse 11, you shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that the prevailing opinion, both in ancient and modern times, has been in favor of the latter, 50 years, not 49 years. And I agree. I think it's 50 years. Well, how can we say it's the 49th year for those who say it's the 49th year? Well, what you have to do is include the Jubilee year from the last cycle. So the last cycle Jubilee year is year one, and then the first day of the next six-year period is day two. So by the time you get to the 49th year, it will be the 50th year. The 49th year numbered normally, it comes out to be the 50th year because you've added that initial year of Jubilee on as year one. Now, there's only one reason that I found that you could say, besides the rabbinic sources that say it was the 49th year, the only reason other than that is that by saying it's 50 years, you require the harvest in year 48 to be huge because that harvest has to cover year 49 and year 50 and year one of the next cycle, three-year harvest. And so the argument goes, it's not reasonable that the Israelites would go 3 years without reaping. One calculation has it, the harvest would have to be four times the normal size. They could eat the year of the harvest in the 48th year, at the end of the year, or during the year after the harvest, assuming they're not eating from a previous year. So that's the 48th year. Then they got to cover the 49th and the 50th year, then the first year of the next cycle. That's 4 years. The harvest would have to be four times its normal size. All right. Well, let's look at the reasons, several reasons why it's the 50th year. First of all, to take care of that fourfold harvest that's needed in the 48th year. As John Gill and Matthew Poole say, God could miraculously bless the harvest fourfold. That's not a problem for him. Second, that's a defensive reason, really. Now let's go into some more affirmative reasons why it's the 50th year. First of all, if you count for the first Jubilee, we're talking about the first Jubilee year, it's just been established. There is no previous Jubilee to count as year one of the cycle. The last cycle is the last cycle, not this cycle. But there was no last cycle. We're just starting for the first time. And even if we weren't talking for the first time, you still got the problem of why would you include the last cycle, the year of Jubilee, in this cycle? It doesn't make any sense. All right, that's the real reason why it's the 50th year. Another reason is that the instructions to not sow on the 50th year is redundant if the 50th year was the same as the 49th year. This is what John Gill and Matthew Poole say. The instruction not to sow on the 50th year is given in Leviticus 25:11. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee, you shall not sow. Well, why would God need to tell Moses, you shall not sow? He's already, if the 50th year is the 49th year, because the 49th year was a Sabbath year, and they would already know they're not supposed to sow on a Sabbath year, so here God's saying, you don't sow on the 49th year, which is we're going to count as the 50th year. Fourth reason why it's the 50th year. This is according to Matthew Poole. The Jews constantly practice it as 50 years, not likely they would err. That, of course, sounds like it contradicts what the NIV Study Bible says, that there's some rabbinic sources that say it's 49 years, but I bet you, I'm not an expert on rabbinic sources about this, of course, but I bet you Matthew Poole is right that the Jews did it on the 50th year for years. The fifth reason why it's 50 is it says 50. Right here in our verses here that we read in verse 11, it's 50. It doesn't say 49. It's just the easiest way to read it. The sixth reason why it's the 50th year, not the 49th year, is by analogy with the common way of computing a Sabbath. This is Matthew Poole's argument. The Sabbath day, was it the first day or the last day of the cycle? No, it was the seventh day of the week. The last day of the week, not the first. How about the Sabbath year? The Sabbath year was year seven, folks. It wasn't the first year of the cycle. So why would the year of Jubilee be any different? All right, so I think we've beat that one to death. It's the 50th year. The year of Jubilee is the 50th year. Now, the proclamation of the year of Jubilee would be at the end of the 49th year on the Day of Atonement, verse 9. Sound a ram's horn on the 10th day of the 7th month. That's Tishri 10, Day of Atonement. It was announced by the blasting of a ram's horn all throughout the land. So that was on the 49th year of Atonement. The next year until the next year of Atonement is the year of Jubilee. Now, going back, I left this little point out. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that it has been argued that it really is the 49th year and that 50 is used as a round number for 49. Well, that's ridiculous. In my humble opinion, that's ridiculous because the 49 is mentioned as a precise number here in verse 8, not as a rounded off number. All right, I said I would not beat that dead horse again. I just did. Sorry about that. Now, a ram's horn is blown on the 49th year on the Day of Atonement. The NIV and the KJV have trumpet, but it's literally, as the NASB has, a ram's horn. I've just been telling you that it was blown at the end of the 49th year to proclaim the start of the 50th year. That's as the pulpit commentary says, the approach of the Jubilee in the following year was announced. I think that is easy to say. Now, why is the Day of Atonement a good time to blow the trumpet announcing the year of Jubilee? Well, because on the Day of Atonement, people had just come out of the fasting and mourning period of the Day of Atonement. Now they're entering into the joyous celebration of the freedom gained in the year of Jubilee. The Jubilee, of course, is a type of our forgiveness of sins. So you got the atonement for sins on the Day of Atonement, then you got the freedom from the penalty of and punishment of sin coming later on the year of Jubilee. The symbolism is just perfect. Before resurrection, there has to be crucifixion. Before deliverance, there has to be bondage. You got the bad news first and then the good news later. The bad news for Jesus was he had to be crucified. The good news is he was resurrected. Now, let's go to verse 10. You shall proclaim a release through all your land, through the land to all its inhabitants as a year of Jubilee. Well, first of all, what does Jubilee mean? Jubilee literally means a ram's horn blowing, as the Cambridge commentary says, a ram's horn blowing. So, bonk, ram's horn blows, year of Jubilee, everybody's free from their debts. It doesn't say that precisely. It says, each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. The property is talking about the release of property debts. The returning to your family is talking about the release of people from slavery for debt. So, how would this work? Well, let's say that you owed money to a creditor and the creditor foreclosed and you gave the creditor your property as security. You couldn't pay the debt back. And so the creditor foreclosed on your property and now he's living on your property. Say that's year 20. Well, year 50, the creditor has to deed the property back to you and your property is no longer foreclosed on. It's unforeclosed on. It's redeemed. Actually, we use the same term. I foreclosed on a couple pieces of property when I was practicing law, and that's the term that's used. They give you, in South Carolina, the South Carolina law calls it the right of redemption. You foreclose on a piece of property. I think the owner has got a year. It takes forever for you to get clear title, for the bank to get clear title. I was representing the bank, and I realized I've got to give this property owner a year of redemption. He's got a year to come up with the money to pay off the bank, even though he's already defaulted on his loan. Well, that's the idea. You get your property back. Now, remember, all property was the idea behind the Old Testament law is property is not to be alienated out of a tribe so that all the tribes would remain constant. You'd have Judah being Judah and Benjamin being Benjamin and Dan being Dan, because when people would alienate their property, either by a sale to satisfy a debt or just an outright sale, the property is eventually going to come back into the tribe, and every 50 years, the tribal boundaries are just like they were when they started. Now, what's the point of this? Well, that would keep all the prophecies in the Old Testament, which contain references to the tribes. It would make them true. Jesus has got to come from the line of Judah, for example, and the Jubilee requirement that the land comes back to the original owner keeps those tribes intact. Now, the idea of each of you shall return to his family, if you don't have land, but you owe money to someone, and you need money, and you say, I will basically mortgage my liberty. I'll pledge my liberty. You don't really mortgage a person, but you pledge your liberty. And if I can't pay you back, well, then you can take me as your slave, and I'll give you my labor to pay off my debt. That was allowed, but once the 50th year came back, that security interest in your person is gone. And you are allowed to go back home to your family. So you're not going to be alienated out of your tribe. You're going to come back. So all the tribes in the family lines and also in the land itself, they remain intact all the way through the Old Testament period. That was the first purpose of the Year of Jubilee, to prevent the perpetual alienation of estates. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, hence the tribe and family of Christ were readily discovered at his birth. Because just like I said, Jesus had to come from the line of Judah. So Jesus fulfilled and ended the Jubilee, because a fulfillment is an ending of something. So he represented the final release of all debts and all slavery. All right, so that's the first purpose, to keep the tribes distinct until the coming of the Messiah, as John Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Second purpose, to prevent perpetual servitude. God did not want his people to be perpetually poor or to be perpetually slaves. They're going to be free. So it had a legal purpose. The analogy to that is our bankruptcy laws. People that get way into debt will never get out, and so the bankruptcy laws give you a chance to get out. Now, if you're a creditor, you might think that's awful unfair, but you've got to realize that every person that makes a loan factors in the fact that that loan might not be paid back, and the debtor might declare bankruptcy. It's a lot of trouble. You got to hire a lawyer and so forth, but they could do that, and you might not get your money back. So that sort of puts you in a quasi-equity position. You're taking a risk along with the debtor, and that's perfectly just, and it comes from the Old Testament. So that's the second purpose of the Year of Jubilee, to prevent perpetual servitude of God's people. Here's a third purpose, to keep the disparity of income of rich and poor from getting too great. Of course, some people are going to be richer than other people. Abraham was, as we say, filthy rich. He was very rich. But if the poor get to be grinding poor, if you don't have a prosperous yeomanry or a prosperous middle class, that's really bad. It leads to all kinds of unhappiness, social movements, socialism, communism, whatever. You got people pointing out, you got these Jacobins pointing out the misery of the poor, so therefore we've got to make them more miserable by making everybody a slave. So we don't want the poor, the income gap to get too large. The Year of Jubilee helps that. And the fourth reason, as Adam Clark says, is the Year of Jubilee typifies freedom from the bondage of sin. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 11 and 12. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. You shall not sow nor reap in its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. Now the commands about the jubilee year, but not sowing, reaping, or gathering. It's the same command that was given for the sabbatical years in verse 5 of our chapter here in Leviticus 25. Which says, your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, nor and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. Well, that was the Sabbath. This is the Jubilee year. You shall not sow on the 50th year as a Jubilee. You shall not sow, nor reap, nor gather. Verse 12, for it is a Jubilee. It shall be holy to you. Holy means consecrated to God, separated from yourself. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. And that's referring, of course, to crops that grew voluntarily, wildly, spontaneously, without planting and reaping, aftergrowth, voluntary crops. You can eat that, but you don't reap. You don't sow. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 13 through 17. On this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend to buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. Number of years of crops that's left until the Jubilee. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price, and in proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price, for it is a number of crops he is selling to you. So you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. Now verse 13, you shall return to your own property. That means if you were a slave. That's a repeat from verse 10. Now verse 14 says you don't wrong one another. How? By ignoring the fact that the Jubilee year is coming. A seller could overcharge. He could say, I'm going to sell you the land at full price, even though next year there's a Jubilee and I get it back. So the seller can make a bunch of money. The buyer could underpay. He could say, the Jubilee's coming next year. This land's not worth anything. I'm not going to pay you hardly a penny for it. Well, now I have a little problem with that. Everybody knew the Jubilee was coming, so how could anybody cheat anybody? With the Jubilee known, it seems like the price would be a simple matter of bargaining. The price would be discounted the closer you got to the Year of Jubilee, and the buyer would have to release his bought property back to the seller. Clark says, you shall take no advantage of each other's ignorance. Well, why would the parties be ignorant? Everybody knows when the year of Jubilee is coming. I don't know. It just seems that the law is saying that if somebody has a bargaining advantage, which could happen, because a lot of times you have parties who are not equal in their bargaining strength, whoever has it, the buyer or the seller, should not take advantage of the year of Jubilee to leverage his advantage. That's a no-no. Well, this idea of discounting the price, the closer you got to the year of Jubilee, the seller charges less and less for it because the buyer has to give it back sooner and sooner, the closer you get to the year of Jubilee. That makes the buyer really a tenant. The seller of the land is a lessor, the buyer is a lessee. Now, this year of Jubilee was actually used to calculate redemption prices. In Leviticus 27, we're going to see when people need to redeem their property, maybe to pay off a fine, a 20% fine or whatever, or to calculate the value of something they give to the temple. They had to come up with a redemption price, the value of the field. That value of the field has to be discounted the closer the field gets to Jubilee if the field is owned by somebody not in the original family, because he'll have to give it back to the original tribal owner. Leviticus 27:18 says this, if he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. So if you've got to pay 20% to the priest, well, that 20% is going to be reduced a good bit if it's year 48. It's not going to be reduced at all if it's year 1. Leviticus 27:23 says, then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of your valuation up to the year of Jubilee, and he shall on that day give you a valuation as holy to the Lord. Well, that's just a repeat of verse 18. You adjust redemption prices calculated for land based on how soon the year of Jubilee came. So each year, the price of the land would drop by approximately 1/49th. It's not 1/50th, because you couldn't sell the land in the 50th year. Why would one buyer buy a piece of land from a landowner if he knows that as soon as he buys it, he can't use it because it's the year of Jubilee? Seems like you could say the same thing on the 49th year. You buy it in the 49th year, you can't, that's a Sabbath year, you can't plant it then either, so it would have no value then. So really, it ought to be 1/48th every year, but I think most people say it's 1/49th. At any rate, the price has got to be discounted. We go now to Leviticus 25:18-19. You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments so as to carry them out, so that you may live securely on the land. Then the land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. This idea of living securely on the land has to do with keeping the law, and more specifically, violating the Sabbaths is connected with the horrible Babylonian captivity that happened in 586 B.C. Let's read 2 Chronicles 36:21. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. You recall the words of Jeremiah. Jeremiah said, you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. And this verse in 2 Chronicles says the reason is, or it implies, the reason is we got to let Israel, the land of Israel, rest for 7 years, because basically you've planted on it for 70 Sabbath years. All right? So you don't let the land rest, I'll make it rest by taking you out of the land, off the land, so that poor land can have its rest. So the idea is this Sabbath year and 40 and the year of Jubilee is a serious business. If they had kept it, they would have lived securely on the land. They didn't keep the Sabbath years, and they paid for it by exile. Now, notice if they had kept the Sabbath year, you can eat your fill. It's ironic. You don't plant on the Sabbath years or the year of Jubilee, but you still eat. You still eat your fill, even in the sabbatical years. And that's the old principle of the manna principle. On the sixth day, God will produce a lot, so you can rest on the seventh. God has built this into nature, into his own creation, and into people as well as the natural creation. We need to take a break every once in a while, American workaholics. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 20 through 22, and we'll finish up this audio. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Isn't that the typical complaint when people say, oh, I've got to work on Sunday. If I don't work on Sunday, I can't feed my wife and family. Well, that's exactly what people are tempted to say here. You mean I can't plant for a whole year? Verse 21. Well, let me read it again. Verse 20, but if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops, then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. All right, we need to explain years 6 through 9 because all years are mentioned here except the seventh, which is the Sabbath year. Or the sixth year, the harvest comes in. Now, that harvest is used for the seventh year, the Sabbath year. And then it's used for the eighth year because they hadn't sown in the eighth year, so the crop hadn't come in yet for the eighth year. So that's the second year. And then the ninth year, which is the second year of the next seven-year cycle, you can eat the crops because the crop will have come in on the eighth year, the first year of the seven-year cycle. This idea of planting a harvest for 3 years, sixth, seventh, eighth, where you plant it on the sixth year, and then from that harvest you eat on the seventh, eighth, and ninth. Actually, some people say you plant it on the sixth year, you eat the same year of the harvest that you eat. I guess that depends on how good the harvest was from last year. So you could be eating on the sixth year, the seventh year, and then the eighth year, which is the first year of the next cycle, and then finally your harvest comes in because you plant in the first year of the next cycle, which is the eighth year. You plant, and then you harvest on the ninth year, which is the second year of the next cycle. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Leviticus 25, verses 1 through 22. In our next audio, we're going to look at property and the poor, basically talking about redemption of property. This stuff excites the legal part of me that's still interested in the law. Maybe it won't excite you so much, but maybe you'll get something out of it. I hope you stay tuned to see, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.